If you stroll the streets of Dublin, past the flower stalls and street musicians, out to the River Liffey, you come upon a three-masted sailing ship, a replica of the Jeannie Johnston. The original ship took thousands of Irish immigrants, a couple hundred at a time, to America. You can tour the ship now and get a sense of what it was like in the mid-19th century, when 200 people would be crowded into this small space, fleeing famine in Ireland to seek a new life in the new world.
When you look at the size of the ship, it's very hard to imagine what it was like for these people. Now remember, it was a cargo ship, never built for passengers. They came across the Atlantic with their cargo. Rather than go back empty, there was a business there. We'll carry human cargo to make money. An average ticket, about £4 or £5. We're talking close to half a year's wage for these poor farmers.
No one died on this ship, which was unusual in those crossings. There was a ship doctor and good hygiene, which were also unusual. I walked through this cramped space, and I thought about my Irish ancestors, who traveled on a ship like this. Maybe not as nice as this, at the tail end of the Irish potato famine. One of those farmers had to work off his passage for years once he landed in New York. And New Yorkers at that time, in fact, many Americans, had little but contempt for the Irish. They were seen as unkempt and uncouth and an unwelcome addition. I think about my Irish ancestors when I think about refugees and immigrants now. I also think about the German side of my family, the relatives who came in the late 19th century because they didn't want their sons fighting for German expansion. So, starving economic migrants on one side, political refugees on the other, all made a home in the United States, and I'm here as a result. Amidst all the talk of building walls and excluding whole categories of people, I wonder how these immigrants and refugees' kids and grandkids and generations after that will integrate and contribute and shape this century here in the United States, and also in other countries, including the countries from which my ancestors left generations ago. As it turns out, both those countries have pretty complicated histories themselves on borders and belonging, on what it means to put up walls and barriers between East and West in Germany, North and South in Ireland, and on how they feel about being open now, both within and to those coming from outside. Turns out, the old world has something important in this political season to say to the new. This is Whose Century Is It?, a podcast about ideas, trends, and twists shaping the 21st century. I'm Mary Kay Magstead. An old stone castle stands on the banks of the Newry River. It's called Narrow Water because the river here is narrow. It's a storied river. St. Patrick is said to have camped on a sandy stretch of it. Its other name, Clonry, plays off an Irish version of the name that means the King's Valley. The water in this particular stretch also divides northern and southern Ireland. The castle is on the northern side in Newry in County Down. During Ireland's troubles in the 1970s and after, Newry was a particularly troubled place. The IRA, the pro-independence Irish Republican Army, was quite active here. An old friend who grew up in Northern Ireland has taken me here. We stand looking across the river to the shores on the other side, just a stone's throw away, that belonged to the Republic of Ireland. And I hear the story of what happened here on August 27th, 1979.
The IRA set up an ambush. They parked here on the northern side, a large agricultural truck, and they waited for a British Army patrol, it was actually a truck full of soldiers, to come past, and then they detonated the bomb in the truck from across the water here. You can see just on the other side of the water where the castle is. And several soldiers in the truck were killed. A helicopter then arrived from the nearest British Army base and it landed just here to my left where there's the entrance to a large mansion. It was the obvious place for a helicopter to land, but the IRA planted a second bomb there which blew up the helicopter and its occupants, including a very senior Army officer. Altogether, 18 members of the Crown Forces were killed.
This is Irish journalist and author Conor O'Cleary, who you may have heard if you listened to my Brexit podcast in June. If you didn't, you can always go back to it. Connor and I were neighbors, friends, and foreign correspondents together in Beijing in the late 90s. When he heard I was interested in exploring borders and belonging in Ireland, he suggested we take a road trip up here, to this border, which has been in the news more than once. A few years ago, it was, for a more positive reason, the border between the North and the South had been relaxing for some time. I mean, after all, with both the UK and the Republic of Ireland and the EU, there was no real point anymore in having border controls. On top of that, the EU offered to pay part of the cost to build a bridge here, which would have really cut down on travel time going between North and South across narrow water.
The idea of a bridge has been around for a long time, and the European Union agreed that it would fund half the cost, or a large proportion of the cost, if the Northern Ireland Executive would fund the other side of the funding. The problem was that the Minister for Finance in the Northern Ireland Executive was a member of the Unionist Party, very strong unionist. He didn't like the idea of any further connections with the Republic, so he couldn't find the funding to match the European Union's funding, and the project never happened. But it's widely regarded that this minister, Sammy Wilson is his name, took it upon himself to stop the project because he didn't like any further connections with the Republic. It was bitterly resented by people who live around here.
Yeah. How did you feel about it?
I'm personally disappointed because I'd love to see Ireland more united in every way. I agree with the present political arrangements. I think it's as much as Ireland could expect at this time, given the problems in the north that we know about. And I think it was very disappointing that a member of the power-sharing government in Northern Ireland should take it upon himself to block a further connection between Northern Ireland and the Republic.
So I'm looking at borders and identity, and, you know, you've lived on both sides of this border, and Ireland is part of the EU. So how do you place yourself at this point in terms of what you connect most with?
Well, I'm Irish. I'm 100% Irish. Although if you check my DNA, you'll probably find there's Spanish or some other blood there. I've always regarded myself as Irish. I would regard myself also as European. And I think that the fact that Ireland joined the European Union was very instrumental in Ireland finding its feet as a proper independent country, because up to that point, up to the point of independence, we were part of the United Kingdom. After independence, we were still in the shadow of the United Kingdom. We were still regarded as a breakaway province. But once we joined the European Union, we were on equal footing with the United Kingdom government in Brussels. And the two countries began to cooperate in a way that they never had before. They found common cause on certain issues in Brussels. And there's now much greater respect from one country for the other. We now have developed a situation where the two countries are actually very friendly. The Queen of England can come to Ireland and nobody raises an eyebrow anymore. To me, it's disappointing when I see people lapsing into the old ways of unionism, saying not an inch, no surrender, no bridge across the narrow water. That's very disappointing to me because I would like to think that we're all moving forward.
It's kind of a funny thing that there's still resistance about this border in Ireland when both North and South are now part of the EU. Freud used to call this the narcissism of minor differences. Maybe it's easier to just sidestep the whole messy Protestant, Catholic, I'm Irish, I'm British, 500 years of history. And joining the European Union kind of helped the island of Ireland do that. The European Union helped pay for the Irish peace process and provided subsidies to help Northern Ireland's economy, and particularly its farmers. So it's not surprising that most Northern Irish, 56%, voted to stay in the EU and were quite dismayed when the Brexit vote passed. But in a Northern Irish town near the border, I met a Protestant minister's wife named Barbara who voted the other way, though she still seems a little flustered by the results.
And I must confess that I voted thinking that the vote wouldn't have went that way. And then when I awakened that morning and said, oh, the vote has gone that way, I panicked a little.
I'd met a few Polish and other Eastern European immigrants on the streets of this little town before I met Barbara. I tried to talk to them and they said, no English. So I asked Barbara whether she had any concerns about immigrants coming into Northern Ireland.
I would encourage immigrants coming in, yes, but it has to be controlled. Mm-hmm. And I feel that maybe leaving Brexit we would have better control of that situation.
So are there any issues with immigration here in this part of Northern Ireland that bother you, or that
none whatsoever? If anyone comes through that door into our church building, they will be welcomed like anyone else.
But Barbara does still have some strong feelings about identity.
I am British born and bred. I am very much British, was from birth, and I still feel very British.
And do you feel European?
Do I feel European? Yes, it is useful in a sense when you go on holiday to Europe that there is one currency in a lot of the countries, and that movement between different countries was very easy. And yes, and the euro was quite a useful commodity when you were moving around in countries. But I don't really classify myself when I would be asked what nationality I am. I'm British.
Just so that I'm clear, are you ethnically Irish or ethnically English? Like, your ancestors, did they come from England or from Ireland?
They would have, my ancestors would have, you may, from your point of view, may think we were Irish, but we are still having that UK identity. That's really, I still feel myself more British than I do Irish.
Down the road, I met another woman with a very different constellation of identities. Anne McCready, who works in the film industry, had a Scottish father and a Northern Irish mother who was from around here.
My father was a customs officer on the border in the 50s, and that's how he met my mother. My mother worked in a hotel, and she was a cocktail waitress, and he saw her sweeping the steps and said she'd the best legs he'd ever seen.
So he married her, and they had five kids. Anne was born in England, and then the family moved to Scotland. Anne moved back here to Northern Ireland with her teenage daughter when her husband died. But does Anne consider herself British? Not even close.
Like, what you think of first and after is, like, you're Scottish, you're European.
I would say I was Scottish, but I was born in England. I was born in Gravesend in Kent, but I was brought up all my life, you know, from the age of three in Scotland, in Perth, and then in Glasgow. And I am very... For an independent Scotland, but I love being here. And my mother was Irish, and I'm surrounded by Irish people. I spent all my school holidays here, so I'd still be a blow-in. You know, you could be here three generations and you're still classed as an old blow-in that's not from here. Huh. So, but no, I think of myself as Scottish, or certainly Celtic.
And she's deeply disappointed by the Brexit vote and worried about what will happen because of it.
So, no, I think it's awful. And I think the country, the union, would come to a standstill without, you know, people from the EU here working. And also the immigrants from Scotland and Ireland and England that go abroad and live, you know, people seem to forget about them.
Actually, it's hard to forget about Irish immigrants going abroad when there are about 70 million people around the world of Irish descent, compared to about 4.5 million people in the Republic of Ireland, and 6.5 million on the entire island of Ireland, north and south. While Ireland's internal border limited movement over most of the past century, its external borders have seen a lot of coming and going over the centuries.
So migration into Ireland really takes place in waves. So we see the first wave in the 12th century with Anglo-Normans coming in via England.
This is Jane Ohlmeyer. She's a professor of modern history at Trinity College in Dublin. We couldn't connect in person while I was there, so we chatted on Skype.
Then in the 17th century, we see about 350,000 migrants, British. When I say British, I really mean English, Welsh, Scottish. But also the Huguenots are coming in from continental Europe. Quite a lot of Dutch coming in at that point as well. People who have suffered persecution on the continent. Now, I say 350,000, but that's out of a population of 1 million. So that's a huge, huge number of people coming in terms of, if you want, the indigenous population. It's a massive figure, far higher than what we're seeing in contemporary Europe, actually. That obviously did create problems, tensions, because, of course, many of the migrants then became a colonial elite.
And the Irish, I don't know, I was going to say more than any other European nation, have had very direct firsthand experience as migrants, as economic refugees, as political refugees. That goes right back to the 16th century.
Maybe that helps to explain the results of a recent EU-wide survey that shows that Ireland's younger generation feels more positively about immigrants than the younger generations of any other European country. Jane thought that was interesting, but not totally surprising. There's a pretty deep vein of sympathy here for the immigrant experience, given how many Irish were themselves immigrants. And besides that?
We recognize that in a small country, actually, migration can be a real positive. So in other words, it very much enriches Ireland. So especially it was Polish migrants or Eastern European migrants that came and really helped build Ireland.
You know, I was the vice president for global relations at Trinity. And when I would be traveling, talking about studying in Ireland, people would ask me, well, what about racism? And I looked at them like, well, it's not something. I'm very happy that, you know, we don't have these Trump-like figures who are, you know, stirring up racial and ethnic hatred. Now, obviously, we had our problems in terms of Catholics and Protestants, but it's a much more localized, if you know what I mean. And thankfully, it's a thing of the past. But I think it's because nobody feels threatened as well. And they see migration in a much more positive way than certainly I think the UK sees it.
It certainly felt that way to me as I strolled around an outdoor activities fair at Trinity College and chatted with students at the beginning of the academic year. I drifted to where I heard drums at the Afro-Caribbean Club. I got chatting with Kenny Olani, a 20-year-old law and business major. He was born in Nigeria. His family came to Ireland when he was 4.
But I do think I have both sides. I see both sides and I have both views, and I'm multicultural because I'm definitely have the Irish flair, and then being in the EU, there's the European, there's a bit of European. And then obviously being like in the age that we are with technology and stuff, you're connected to like Americans, Asians, and obviously I still have the African roots. So I'd like to think I have a bit of everything, but Ireland is probably all I know. So that's what I'm used to. So, and I love this place. I've always said that I don't really want to move. I want to see the world, but I want to come back here, and this is where I want to set up. It's the best place, I feel, to sort of grow. Because it's not like we're disconnected from the world. It's still part of the EU, so we still have all that offers. And then it's just, for me, it's just the island's just a good place for me. It's just one of the places that I've enjoyed, and it's always feel like home to me.
Think about that a minute. A Nigerian refugee kid grows up in Ireland, feels accepted enough to invest in his education, and happily plans to invest in a life here. It's a story that could also be told many times over in the United States, despite the recent build a wall, send them home rhetoric coming out of certain quarters. Interestingly, though, while the Irish seem pretty tolerant of outsiders coming in, Ireland has taken very few Syrian refugees. The government pledged to take 4,000, also a fairly small number, but those who have actually come so far is a small fraction of that. Meanwhile, in the other country from whence my ancestors came, Germany has taken in 800,000 refugees over the past year and a bit. Germany, the land that once made Aryan purity a rallying cry, opened its borders and let desperate people in. Of course, that didn't come without a political cost. A right-wing, anti-immigrant party called Alternative for Germany won more votes than expected in local elections over the past year, including in Chancellor Angela Merkel's home constituency. In one local election, in Saxony-Anhalt, they won almost 25% of the vote. In Berlin, just over 14%. Berlin, one of the world's great cosmopolitan cities, but also a city that still bears the scars of its own division. Here on Bernhardstrasse was one of the places where the wall stood. It divided the street down the middle, marooning a cemetery and a church, but that wall was meant to keep people in. Where the wall once stood, there's now the Berlin Wall Memorial. Where I'm standing, I can see a sculpture of poles that form a kind of a wall that you can look through and walk through. And there are also recordings that you can listen to of voices from a time when trying to get past the real wall could have gotten you killed.
Ich sage, Jeder Schuss aus der Maschinenpistole eines unserer Grenzsicherungsposten.
This is Albert Norden. He was the head of propaganda for East Germany. And this is a speech he gave in 1963. Here's the translation of what he's saying.
You are not shooting at brothers and sisters when you stop a border violator with your weapon. How can he who betrays the Republic, who questions the power of the people, be your brother? Nor is he our brother who wants to desert to the enemy.
The memorial includes the names and photos of dozens of those killed, trying to escape East Germany, trying to live beyond the wall. Now, in one neighborhood of East Berlin, Syrian refugees have come in, and they're grateful for being there. I've come to this neighborhood with another friend you may have heard in the Brexit podcast back in June, Jutta Liesch. We also were friends, neighbors, and colleagues when we were both based in Beijing, up until 3-4 years ago. Jutta is now at the newspaper Die Tageszeitung, or TAZ, in Berlin. And since I don't speak German, she generously offered to translate for me. We walked up to the apartment compound that houses Syrian refugees. We saw a little kid on a bicycle riding around in circles. We saw women on their doorsteps chatting to each other. And we met a couple of 28-year-old guys named Fadi and Ahmed. They've been in Germany almost a year, and their German's coming along. They're spending about 8 hours a day in class. Fadi was an auto dealer and then a security guard in Hama.
Ich habe Frau in Syrien. Mein Vater, mein Mutter, mein Tochter, mein Bruder in Syrien.
His whole family is still in Syria, his father, his mother, his daughter and his brother.
3 Jahre alt, nicht gesehen.
He hasn't seen them for 3 years.
Nicht kommt nach Deutschland.
They can't come to Germany.
Straße, Probleme.
He has no money. So for the way.
Neun Stadt nach Deutschland.
It's too expensive to come to Germany.
Fadi shrugs and looks forlorn. He says life is uncertain now. He's been given permission to stay in Germany for a while, but not necessarily forever. He'd like to work, but he doesn't yet have the documents that would allow him to do that. Ahmed is in better shape. He's a tailor from Aleppo. His wife and kids are here, and he does have papers to work.
Kurs und Schule und nach Arbeit und Kinder und yani alles.
Have a whole future here. Have the courses, have school, have work, have children, everything.
So do you guys feel... I mean, how much do you feel that you're kind of being accepted and encouraged to integrate here?
Yeah. In Deutschland, immer helfen. Mm-hmm. Alles people, I have English. Good. Mit her, mit Frau. Yeah.
He said, yes, people are helping.
Okay. Aber ich habe in Syrien Probleme mit Bashar Assad, jeden Tag, Bomba, People, Aleppo, Hama, Dara, Ladakane,
alles Syrien.
Homs, alles Syrien.
Jeden Tag.
So there was everyday bombings on all these cities, and he had day problems every day with the regime of Assad.
Bashar Assad is good.
It's a lot better here, they say. But that's not to say it's perfect. A friend of theirs comes on a bicycle. He's another refugee, off to see his girlfriend. I asked them all how the neighbors around here are with them. One makes a so-so gesture with his hand, and then they all start talking at once. Here's Ahmed, the tailor.
Good. Security.
Ein Mann und Abend gehen zu Heim.
Zehn Personen.
Zweimal Deutschland und Mann, Männer und Müsse und hier.
He said his wife was walking in there quickly, but there was a group of men a couple of evenings ago with a knife, and they were threatening.
They were threatening your wife?
Yeah. Not your wife, but...
Not wife, men.
They were threatening the men.
Yeah. Deutsche Männer und Serbisch.
Zusammen.
Nicht Arabisch.
So German and Serbian men together, and they were drunk.
And then, they say, there was a time a couple of months earlier when a bunch of people came late at night in cars and drank and played loud music right at their gate until someone called the police, and the police broke it up. Compared to Aleppo, this is nothing, but it's also not exactly comfortable. Across the street from the apartment complex with the refugees is a community with cottages and gardens where families come on weekends, and some live full-time. Yuta and I stopped to talk with a woman pruning her hedges. Her name is Karin, a middle-aged former nursery school teacher, blonde, blue-eyed, matronly, friendly. We ask how it is living near the refugees.
Was wirklich unangenehm ist, das ist, dass sie abends oder nachts erst munter werden.
She said it's a very mixed picture, and there are some very nice people in there and some other people who are not so nice. There have been problems, because especially now that some people have been here for a longer time, they feel more at home. And the problem is that many people in the evening, they start being lively, and then they make very loud music. And then if somebody here asks them to please be quiet, they will shout back, shut up. So that is something that people don't like very much.
They also didn't like that the government first told them there would be no refugees housed in this neighborhood. And then they heard a report on television saying the refugees were coming.
Diese schlechte Information ist...
The bad thing is, on Monday they watched it on television, on Wednesday they had the meeting in the church, and on Friday the buses were coming. And this is not only something that happened here in this area, but also in other places, where the local population was not informed well, just suddenly people came, and that's why people were so angry.
Some of the neighbors said at the community meeting that they worried crime would go up, robbery especially. That hasn't happened. Some of the neighbors have even come to the refugee center and offered fruit from their trees.
Es sind Menschen wie Sie, ja, wie jeder, gut und nicht so gut, und man soll helfen. Ja.
She says there are people like you and me. Some are good, some are not so good, and one has to help.
Going forward from here, what would you like to see happen in terms of how much Germany accepts refugees? Do you think that there still should be a place for giving asylum, or that this is enough already?
Also auf alle Fälle müsste erstmal in den Ländern, wo Krieg ist, Frieden geschaffen werden.
So just first thing is, you have to see that people in the places where there's wars. We cannot have these wars, and at the same time, Germany is one of the biggest weapon dealers in the world and exporters. So we cannot on the one hand side say there should be no war, but at the same time send more weapons there.
Wenn ich ein Feuer mache und dann mit Wasser lösche, oder ja, es geht nicht, das ist zweischneidig, das geht nicht.
What about immigration in general? I mean, are you comfortable with having kind of a more multicultural mix?
Also ich habe nichts dagegen, aber ich erwarte wirklich von den...
I'm not against, but what I expect is that people who come to us, that they accept us, that they try to respect our traditions and our way of life, and that they will also change into our way of life and basically accept us the way we are.
Karin has lived in this neighborhood since she was born. She grew up with the Berlin Wall. Now that it's gone, and what used to be East Germany is part of the open border European Union, it's still a bit of a strange new world. And while Karin seems a thoughtful, caring, even-handed person in dealing with all this change and all these new refugees, not all former East Berliners are like that. Not all Germans are, East or West. At another refugee center in Hellersdorf district, a group contracted to work there was fired when its members were found to be sending around emails joking that a good way to spend an extra bit of money they had would be to get a child guillotine for the, quote, maximally pigmented. A few minutes' walk from the Berlin Wall Memorial near Bernardstrasse is the office of the Amadeo Antonio Foundation. Amadeo Antonio was a black Angolan who came to work in a small town in former East Germany as a contract worker in 1987. 3 years later, a year after the Berlin Wall fell, some locals beat him unconscious with a baseball bat, and he died. He was the first known casualty in a hate crime in newly reunified Germany. I visited Berlin in the early 90s myself. A journalist friend and I, at the end of August 1992, ended up going up to Rostock, where there'd been skinhead protests and attacks against Turkish and Vietnamese guest workers. The night we were there, the police used tear gas on the skinheads, and we caught a whiff or two of it ourselves. The skinheads threw rocks at us, the journalists, because they thought we were biased against them. And the Turkish and Vietnamese immigrants lived in fear, because just a few nights earlier, protesters had been throwing rocks and petrol bombs at the apartment complex where they lived. No one died, but it wasn't for lack of trying. Those were the worst anti-immigrant riots since Germany was reunified. Annette Kahane remembers that time all too well. She's the chairperson of the Amadeo Antonio Foundation, which tries to work for tolerance and against anti-Semitism, racism, and right-wing extremism. And for Annette, this is personal. Her parents were both in concentration camps in France during the war. Her father was both a communist and a Jew. He escaped and fought in the resistance as a captain.
So I was born in the 50s, and I grew up thinking that this should be a good idea to have socialism. One thing was what I saw and what I lived through, and the other thing was what my parents told me to feel about the GDR. So it was a very ambivalent thing.
What did they tell you to feel?
Well, they said, well, this is the kind of society we were fighting for and we were suffering for, and they also have been in concentration camps, so this was a big deal of suffering and fighting for a little girl, you know, to say, oh, okay, so they were suffering so much and fighting so much, who am I to disagree, you know, and this is a really bad trap.
Western Germany was going through decades of self-examination and atonement for its Nazi past, but East Germany acted like it had never been part of the problem.
So this was what the communists were hoping for. They said, well, anti-Semitism is a kind of a result of capitalism, and as we don't have capitalism anymore, so there's no anti-Semitism anymore and no racism, and this is the only reason. This is the only reason for all these ugly things is capitalism. So no capitalism, no racism, no anti-Semitism. Easy, easy thing. Now we start, we don't talk about that anymore. We don't talk about Jews. Jews are just human beings like everybody else, so don't mention them anymore. Don't mention this. There was terrible victims in the war. All the peoples in Europe had victims from this terrible fascist war, just from Hitler and his crew. And this was just a small group. And the terror was just something that was coming from them. And this had nothing to do with the working class people. And they were all the same kind of victims. The Jews, also Jews, yes, of course. But all the other victims of the war were as victims as all everybody else. So there was no discussion about how the mechanism of anti-Semitism was and the advantage the German people took from robbering. No word, nothing. GDR was just saying, we don't have to do that. We are not responsible for the war. We are completely different. We are a working class society, and that's why we don't care for the Jews. Don't talk about it. It was a real taboo. I mean, the taboo is if you don't know the word Jew anymore, if you forget about that, yeah. If this is disappearing completely, there's no Holocaust, there's no Jew. Sometimes, of course, and that happened to me as well, this is popping up like, kids in the school telling Jew jokes about ashes and things. Of course, there was always jealousy. Of course, there was always suspicious attitude. And this was what they felt about me and I felt about them was, you know, imagine I was living in a socialist country that was supposed not to be anti-Semitic, but I saw the opposite.
So now, with the rise of AfD, the Alternative for Germany, Alternative for Deutschland, it has a fair bit of support in what used to be Eastern Germany, but not only there. So I'm wondering how, like, to what extent you think the wall, the division, the difference in governance and in approaching the problems of history, how much that's had a lasting effect in how people think about outsiders, like refugees coming in, as well as about anti-Semitism or, you know, being mindful of not being anti-Semitic?
I think this is a very special time in Germany now because the entire society is becoming very nervous. It's becoming very tense, the atmosphere, after sleeping for 30 or 40 years. You know, this little interruption with the wall came down, but this was a very happy interruption. And afterwards, they had this up and downs and economy. And now the AfD is there. And they're telling very clearly, more clearly than everybody else, what they were really feeling about. Yeah. And now they can say what they really think. It's about the immigrants. You know, it's about these people who are looking different. It's about racism. And if there is something they really don't want, is that this is what they tell us every time. They don't want that their conditions in East Germany will turn like they are in West Germany, with all these immigrants, with all these multicultural movements, with all these lesbian gays and da-da-da-da-da, and all this confusion, all these individual rights, all this, you know, interests of identities of different. They want to see themselves as the people, you know, the Germans, and they don't want to be disturbed by anybody who is different, you know. And this is the core of the idea.
I've never understood this concept of nation, because what is of nationality as a point of identifying yourself or being proud of? Huh? I mean, I was the last year maybe, just when Merkel said, "Okay, come," huh? That was maybe one moment I was really a little bit proud of my country. Huh?
This is Bernd Pickert. He's a colleague of Jutta's at her newspaper, Taz, and we're sitting out at the paper's sidewalk cafe, just down the street from the old Checkpoint Charlie, the best-known Berlin Wall crossing point in the bad old days. These days, Bernd is all for opening up and allowing a more multicultural Germany. He works as a volunteer with refugees. He opened a bike repair shop near the refugee apartment compound that Jutta and I visited. He takes donated bikes, fixes them up with help from refugees, and then offers them to other refugees so they'll have more mobility. And there are plenty of people in Berlin and in Germany like him, volunteers who want the refugees to be able to settle in and feel comfortable and feel welcome. He wishes there were even more. But it doesn't surprise him that the anti-immigrant Alternative for Germany party has gained ground since Chancellor Merkel opened the door to refugees last year.
I see it more or less as a normalization of Germany in the European context. Because, I mean, after all, Germany was almost the only country where no right-wing populist party had some significance. If you get to Britain with UKIP, if you get to France, if you get to Switzerland, Austria, even the Nordic countries, Scandinavia, not to mention the Eastern European countries. In every country, there was a more or less strong right-wing party, not in Germany. Because in Germany, it was all smooth, everything was okay, nobody feared nothing. And now things are changing. And not only because of the refugee crisis, but also because of social deterioration within our own country. And so it's quite normal. And as long as it stays between 12 and 20%, what they usually over the last nine elections gotten, I'm okay with that.
And here, I'm wondering, is that what we've got going on in the United States, too?
that there will always be a core population of people who will resist change, resent those who aren't like them, revere those who offer easy answers and play on their worst fears? Maybe. And if so, Byrne thinks we could all do better in dealing with people who feel that way, like those who support Alternative for Germany, or by its German acronym, AFD.
Well, I mean, one of the key elements of political thinking of AFD voters is that the mainstream press is lying. And that is, it's a system-controlled press, and that nobody cares for their concerns of what common citizens think or what they suffer. So there is a danger in everybody else closing ranks against AFD, because just to marginalize those people, the voters, wouldn't help. And that's the same a little bit with Trump voters in the United States, I think. I mean, I just read I don't remember if it was a book or a thesis, that the so-called white trash people are almost the only population group which can be discriminated against without fearing to be accused of political incorrectness. And that is sort of, it's true. And so we should be careful in doing this. So, yes, I want to take serious the concerns of those people, but convert it to a fact-based concern. And whenever we have in our neighborhood, we have discussions with concerned citizens, concerned about the refugee situations, we don't try to condemn them and say, go away, I don't want to... But rather convince them or invite them to come to the center, to get to know people, to get to know the situation, sort of appealing to the capacity of empathy. Because after all, they are human beings too, and there might be some assholes who really don't have this. But that's not the majority, even of AFD voters.
Not a bad thing to keep in mind in this political season, huh? Because after the U.S. presidential election, we'll all be moving in some direction together. Or maybe sitting idle in dysfunction, who knows? Whatever happens, there are few issues that hit more of an emotional chord or more of an emotional nerve than issues related to borders and belonging. Where should the borders be? Who should be inside them? Who should be outside? Who gets to decide and based on what? And what happens if those on either side of a given border or wall or boundary, or even those on the same side, don't agree? We've seen some of the answers to those questions play out over time in Ireland and Germany. Each has wrestled with its demons. Each has been open in different eras over time to waves of immigrants and refugees, with wildly varying degrees of tolerance once they settle in. And as to what might happen as the century unfolds, it's a pretty safe bet that borders won't go away in this century, but neither will attempts to cross them in search of a better, safer life. Within that tension, when I think about whose century this is, I think about my Irish and German ancestors and the Nigerian refugee kid who's now a well-spoken Trinity College law and business major, repaying a warm welcome in his adopted homeland with love and loyalty. Sure, there are assholes, as Byrne so eloquently put it, but most people are not. Most immigrants and refugees are not. Most ultimately enrich the places where they choose to live. So here's hoping, as we go forward, that, reasonable security precautions aside, tolerance wins out over tribalism and hope over fear. That wraps up my trilogy of podcasts on immigration, identity, and borders. If you missed the first two, you can find them on our webpage, pri.org/century, along with print versions, photos, and links. We're also on iTunes and most other podcast apps. And if you like the podcast, do me a favor and rate it and leave a review. It helps. My Twitter handle is Mary Kay Magstad. That's MaryKayMagistad, all one word. And you can send a longer message to whocentury@gmail.com. And that leaves me to say that Whose Century Is It is a co-production between me and PRI's The World in cooperation with the BBC World Service and WGBH. It's funded by a grant from the Henry Luce Foundation. Thanks for listening. Join us next time.